Alex Izadorczyk is the founder and CEO of CyberSynth, a data as a service company on a mission to build a real-time understanding of the world's economy. He is also the author of Magis, a newsletter focused on data, finance, and modern economics. Alex, welcome to The Splinter.
Thanks for having me.
So, Alex, every startup founder, regardless of industry, is faced with the same important question at inception, which is why now? Your answer to this question is an especially interesting one, and it revolves around this idea you call the external data hypothesis. So I'd love to start there and hear you describe that concept for our listeners.
Sure, yeah. So I think it's no surprise to anyone that data science, data analytics, big data, AI, whatever you wanna call it, has become massively popular. And there's probably no organization in the Fortune 500 that doesn't have a data science team. The hypothesis, though, is based around the fact that those teams are generally internally or internal facing. So they make use of internal data. And that's great. And the last 10 years have really been sort of a maturity of that concept. But unless you're literally Google, you probably only have 1% of the information about your own customers or your own business or the macroeconomic factors affecting your business as you could have. And so at some point, you have to start looking to the outside, to external data sets. You could call this market research, but what it is using data from outside of your org to help make decisions. So I think that in many ways, I think the world is ready for this. I think a few things have changed that make this more pressing beyond just that internal data efforts have matured. So I think those things are, first of all, there's been a digitization of the entire economy. There's basically nothing you can do today that is not recorded in a database somewhere. Even if you go to a store and pay in cash, that's being recorded on the store's digital POS system. So unlike 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago, every action we take is in a database. And it's just a question of getting access to that database. And if you do, you can answer any sort of business question. So I think that's, reason number one. I think reason number two is what I call the modern data stack. So just the tools for slicing and dicing data have gotten so much better. And obviously I'm partial to Snowflake, but there's a very large ecosystem of tools that make it easy and interactive for people to make use of their data. And this matured as people built internal data science teams. It sort of wasn't true in, say, the Hadoop era. And then, finally, I think that privacy restrictions, moving towards a cookieless world, the IDFA changes, all of this means that people are restricted in what data they can collect on their own customers and what sort of PII data they can use. And so looking for third-party sources of anonymized aggregated information becomes interesting. And so I think those three things are sort of why external data matters right now so much and why I think it's a good time to build a data as a service or market research company. I think an unexpected tailwind has been AI. And when I started CyberSyn, I did not anticipate the uptake ChatGPT would have. And so, this has been an unexpected and fortunate tailwind.
Before launching CyberSyn, I know you spent almost 7 years at Coatue, which is a large hedge fund, as their head of data science, helping them build out their data infrastructure, their research, and their insights functions. At a practical, almost day-to-day level, when you were the one in the driver's seat building models, how did your time there inspire what eventually became this appreciation for external data?
Well, we were buying data, and we were, we weren't. Coatue is a hedge fund. So there was no internal data at Coatue that was helpful in studying the questions we were investing in, if you will. So if you wanted to learn about Netflix or you wanted to learn about Meta, you had to look for external, like an outside in point of view. And so in that modeling process, the first step was acquiring data. So I spent a lot of time with data vendors and market research firms and sort of pushed the limits of their product offerings in terms of what they could offer. And ultimately that is what led me to think there's room for a new approach.
I've often heard you say it yourself, DaaS businesses are nothing new. What is new, however, is the emergence of so-called alternative data. How do you describe this category of data? And broadly speaking, when compared to more traditional data, what do you think makes it so valuable to investors and businesses?
Yeah, well, I think alternative data, unfortunately, is poorly named. What the term refers to, or the history of the term, is that in financial services, I think data as a service is not new in any industry. Market research is not new. But in financial services in particular, there was a dominant use of fundamental accounting data and market data like prices and volumes. And so this was traditional market accounting fundamentals data. And so when sort of new types of data started being used in the investing process, it got the name alternative data because it was alternative to the traditional stuff you were used to buying from Bloomberg, S&P, FactSet, and so on. It's a misnomer because today Bloomberg, FactSet, and S&P offer alternative data, so it's no longer really alternative to anything. And outside of the investing and hedge fund space, the term doesn't really mean anything because you could have been using market research all along. I think, though, what the term semantically refers to is using real-time, so granular and fast economic data around consumer or business actions. And I think that is somewhat new. So think credit, debit card data, or point of sale data that is granular. So you can sort of anonymously see what cohorts of consumers do sequentially. And that gives you a level of speed and a level of granularity in the questions you can ask that weren't available in sort of the traditional thing you think of when you think market research.
Cybersyn is hard at work collecting and selling two large categories of information, public data and private data. Starting with the former, I've heard you describe it as hidden public data. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think people just don't recognize how much public data is out there, mostly as a result of our tax dollars at government agencies being put to work. There's hundreds of agencies around the world that publish really high quality data and make all types of things available that could be used before spending any money on data. So just to give examples of kind of creative things, the European Space Agency makes satellite imagery available for free. Another example is in the United States, the Department of Labor makes health benefit information for every employer with more than 10 employees available as a matter of public record. So if you want to know if a given business uses Aetna or Cigna, that's a public record, as are the number of employees that are covered under those benefit plans. A third example would be every medical professional in the U.S. is included in the NPPES database and has an NPI identifier. So if you want to know how many chiropractors there are in New York City, that's a public record that's updated weekly. So I think there's just like, and I can go on and on, there's just hundreds of these examples of data sets that could be immensely useful, but they're hidden behind some maybe archaic government websites. And then, you know, there's many such websites, so sorting through that is difficult. And then even if you find that data, joining it all together to make it useful is hard. And so that's what we're really trying to solve.
You've hinted at it already, but Cybersyn, rather than launch your own native marketplace, has partnered with Snowflake. And so when it comes to making this hidden data accessible and neatly organized, how does your partnership with Snowflake come into play?
Yeah, so and I think that's really important. So people often, you know, ask me, is Cybersyn a platform? And the answer is no. We are never intended to be a marketplace ourselves. We're a content company. So when we say data company, we don't mean data infrastructure. We mean like actual data content. So Snowflake is a major investor and our technology partner in sharing and distributing data. I was a large Snowflake customer at Coatue, We also became investors in Snowflake at Coatue. And so I got to know the team there. You know, everybody from various PMs to the former CEO, Frank. And, you know, I think I was fortunate to build a partnership with them. And when I left Coatue, there was an opportunity to effectively co-found a company with Snowflake. I felt that Snowflake could help with distribution and with resources. Well, at the same time, I could do what I do best, which is focus on combining these unique data sets. So the analogy I like to give is if Snowflake is Netflix, then we're trying to build the original content layer for that Netflix.
Getting back to public data, I've noticed that Cybersyn recently debuted a new product offering called Enterprise Public Data, drawing on sources like SEC filings, FDIC data, and bank settlements. It's obviously incredibly useful information, which leads me to a sort of naive question. Why have your competitors, large incumbents like Bloomberg and Reuters, overlooked what is clearly such a valuable resource?
So I think there's a few pieces to this. I think that, so we basically give away a lot of public domain data on the Snowflake marketplace. And as large enterprises have started to use that data, we've been asked for things like support, SLAs, faster feeds, and sort of all these features that actually cost us a lot to put out there. And so we've began charging for these features and calling it sort of the enterprise package. So we still provide a lot of data for free for the Snowflake community, but if you're using it in production in an enterprise setting, you might want to consider the enterprise package to get these kind of production grade, enterprise grade features. So that's kind of the product itself. In terms of our competitors, I don't think they've overlooked it per se, in the sense that we certainly cover a lot of data sets that some of our competitors cover. I think that there's a few things that have maybe changed in the world that open the door for a new type of data provider. So I think, you know, first and foremost, we're native to Snowflake, and we distribute all of our data, our entire catalog, through Snowflake. The traditional method of selling data, and I won't, you know, name any particular competitor, but just in general, traditionally, the way you buy data is you call a salesperson, you have a sales meeting. After the sales meeting, they introduce you to a specialist, you talk to the specialist, you sign a contract for a trial, you do a trial, you make a buying decision, and the whole process takes like 4 weeks or 6 weeks. And most users of data really dislike this. It's quite difficult to go to a large data vendor and just say, show me every table of data you have, and let me just try whatever I want and then decide if it's worth the price. And so Snowflake Marketplace kind of allows this paradigm of try before you buy and make it self-service, right? So you can talk to us if you want to, but before you even talk to us, you could just sort of try the data. Our whole catalog is on Snowflake, not just parts of it. We fully integrate with all the latest Snowflake features, including the sort of data previews, data dictionaries, and so on. So I think in some ways, it's not as if the content we're offering the legacy providers could never offer. It's just the form factor in which we're offering it, I think, is unique. That's point number one. I think point number two is there are some data sets we can offer that our competitors don't offer from the public domain space, mostly because we can move very quickly and nimbly to process that data. And so, again, in the old world, you needed like tens or hundreds of people, often offshore people, to do data quality control, data parsing, structuring data, and so on. And, you know, technology has kind of changed that. Right. And especially specifically LLMs, AI. I mean, that's the buzzword everybody wants to talk about, but also just other features within the Snowflake platform, like the data quality features they just released, for example, that basically allow you to ingest more data at a high quality with fewer people. And that allows us to move very quickly. And every time there's a new valuable data source we discover in the public domain, we can immediately offer it. And I think that just will hopefully compound to a volume of data and a variety of data that our competitors maybe can't keep up with because the method of producing that data is just completely different than what it used to be. So I think those two things are sort of key.
Hearing you describe it, it sounds like finding, cleaning, and selling publicly available data sounds to me like very much an engineering challenge, whereas I'd imagine that finding, cleaning, and selling private data would be much more of a scouting exercise. You and your colleagues have to go out into the world and find untapped, undervalued, non-traditional sources of information. I'm sure that many partners you approach might be eager to monetize this valuable asset that they probably didn't even realize they were sitting on. But on the flip side, I'd also imagine that a lot of these potential partners might be hesitant to make their data more broadly available, especially potentially to their competitors.
Sure.
So all that being said, what does this sourcing process look like in practice?
Yeah. So, you know, I disagree. I don't think we're necessarily looking for undervalued data. Like, we're not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. I think data partnerships work when the deal is fair and set up to sort of exist for the long term. So I think that in some ways we're paying high prices for data to make it worth it for everybody. That said, it is true that, you know, there is business development and discovery conversations that have to happen. So it's a little bit of like a reverse sales process where we have to find partners and help those partners monetize their data with us. I think the competitive concern is real. So you do need to put safeguards in place that, you know, if you buy data from company A, you can't give that data to company B if they're a direct competitor. But you could use that data in a third-party industry that has nothing to do with those industries, but might still inform some business decision, right? So I think that is a key distinction and very important in your data contracts. I also would say that the things that are the same about public data and proprietary data is that they actually both require a fair bit of data engineering and data science. And so a lot of it is around cleaning and joining data. And I think joining is really the key where, okay, it's great. You know, you might have a really valuable data set, but it's probably the most valuable if you could join it to all the commodity data sets. And so what is that join key, right? Let's say company name, or let's say website, or let's say geography, like jurisdiction. You really need to find a way to standardize data sets on a sort of entity graph. And creating that entity graph and then mapping all the data sets against that entity graph is sort of the name of the game. And that process is the same whether you use proprietary data or public domain data. Like, one of our aims is when you use a Cybersyn data set, we want it to sort of feel like every other Cybersyn data set. So that if I didn't tell you this was the Cybersyn data set, you could kind of guess by the way the data was structured, by the way the entities were named, by the way the columns were arranged. And that should be the same across both proprietary data and public domain data.
When you mention including restrictions in contractual agreements to ensure that company A doesn't receive data from company B if they're in the same category, could you give me an example? Would this be like, you know, GM's data not being available to Ford, but maybe being available to an insurance company?
Yeah, that's a great example.
To contextualize a little bit further, I've noticed that another recent addition to the Cybersyn catalog is consumer spending data, which is a pretty broad category. So yeah. Can you help us understand the kind of measures that are included in that panel data? And second, what sources these insights are derived from?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the proprietary side of our data business, we've focused on the consumer economy. You can't boil the ocean, you gotta start somewhere. And so we're starting with where consumers in aggregate are spending money and time. And the goal is to be able to help businesses make optimal decisions, or investors make optimal decisions, based on anonymized aggregate consumer trends. And so the first question we have to be able to answer, and some of our early product, is just around how much money does a given business make? So, you know, what is Walmart's run rate this month? Or how much revenue does this particular Walmart location make, right? So those are the base level questions, just time series, estimates at a merchant level around sort of the revenue potential of particular businesses, and then particular businesses in particular geographies, and then eventually specific storefronts. That's kind of step one. And then step two, to make it a little bit more complex, is then to start asking questions about cross-shopping behavior. So do people at store A also shop at store B? Do people at store C, are they a higher propensity or lower propensity to also go to store A? What is the retention like of this particular brand or service? You know, what products within a given store are driving growth? What is the total sale of that product across the entire country? So, and the use case is basically you start out with a benchmarking use case. So how is my business performing against the economy? How is my business performing against my competitors? And how is my business performing against the hyper-local competition next door? That's kind of like the first set of questions. And then the next set of questions we try to answer with that consumer spending data is sort of what is the total addressable market for my customer segments? So what are the, you know, types of people that shop at my company or my brand or that buy my CPG product? And, you know, this is not specifically naming people or anything like that. It's just grouping people into behavioral patterns, right? So video gamers who drink a lot of caffeine and watch sports versus suburban moms that drive minivans and shop at Costco, right? And really trying to understand how big are those demographic groups and what are they likely to do next, right? And so there's really three types of data or three sources of data that we try to combine. And those sources are credit, debit card, and payment data. So I would call this payment data. So this is merchant level information. It's all anonymized, it's all aggregated. But, you know, conceptually, if you picture your mobile banking account and you look at the transactions there, right, that is conceptually the type of data we're talking about. The second kind of data is what I call point of sale data. So this is what is being bought in the store. So, you know, are you buying Pepsi or are you buying Coke? Are you buying a 6-pack of Coke or the 12-pack, right? And then the last piece of data is digital behavior data. So what apps are you using? What are you watching on Netflix? What websites are you browsing? So those are the three sort of categories of data, and the goal is to stitch that together to be able to answer these kind of insights-related questions.
You alluded to it, but is CyberSyn currently focused on providing raw data, or does the company also produce sort of a level two analysis package to go along with that data?
So it depends what you mean by raw data, right? Raw, you know, data can be raw in various forms. We provide, we are a seller of time series data. So folks come to us, we don't sell, you know, like granular raw data from the cash register. We're selling effectively analytics. Now those analytics come in the form of a data feed. And that data feed, it's a price time series, or it's a revenue or sales time series, right? So similar, you know, I like to joke that CyberSyn is kind of like what the US Census Bureau would be if they were trying to make money. Right. So we're selling, here's our estimate of sales at these retailers over these days or weeks, or here's what we think the total addressable market for these products are. And we sell that as a data feed through the Snowflake Marketplace. Now, what we've also discovered is that in order to sell data, you often have to visualize it because your buyer is often not able to, you know, jump in the weeds right away. They want to see, what can I do? What is the art of the possible with that data? And so we also build dashboards and tools to demonstrate what the data can do and give people a jumping off point.
Hearing you describe it, it's obviously incredibly valuable data because in the right hands, for example, an investment analyst could almost maintain a sort of living, breathing, live company income statement and try to surface trading signals before they become consensus. It's something you've written about, saying that, quote, portfolio managers, particularly those with long-term mandates, are looking to find early indications that a new behavior is taking off before it's obvious in top-line results. And in that same essay, you go on to draw a really interesting comparison between portfolio managers and professionals working in consumer packaged goods, writing that, quote, "The other obvious examples are brand or category managers at CPG firms. Similar to portfolio managers, these folks do not have direct access to first-party sales data, since the transactions happen at retailers, not manufacturers, and so must rely on third-party external data." Can you explain the significance of that? How do you see this data becoming valuable to folks in the CPG and retail space specifically?
Sure. So, you know, it's kind of funny, what do hedge fund analysts have to do with marketing professionals at CPG firms? You'd think nothing. But actually, I would argue it's surprisingly a lot, right? So you know, the hedge fund analyst wants to understand how businesses are performing, to basically understand whether businesses will exceed or disappoint expectations. The category manager or consumer insights manager at a large CPG company has the same problem. They don't own their relationship with their consumer. Their consumer goods are being sold through retailers. So just like a hedge fund, they actually don't have first-party data of what gets sold at the retail storefront. And not only do they not have data on their own products, they certainly don't have data on their competitors' products. And so they need to do two things. First, they need to understand their performance and their market share. You can imagine if you're Coke, you would like to know how you're doing against Pepsi in, say, Kroger's, right? That's kind of like the first question. Again, I would call this the benchmarking question. This is very similar to what hedge fund analysts do. The customer insights or category manager will go a step further because, unlike the hedge fund analyst, they're not just an observer of what's happening. They are also an agent for change. So based on what they see in that data, they might choose to take an action. For instance, they might choose to allocate more trade dollars. They might choose to alter pricing. They might choose to different type of advertising scheme, for example. And then after they do that, they need to be able to A/B test and attribute the results of those efforts and the ROI on those efforts to impact in sales. You also have other types of use cases at these CPG firms, like discovering what new products, what niche small brands are taking off, right? This is not too different than what a hedge fund analyst or maybe a venture capitalist analyst would be doing with the data. You take a look at the data, you're like, what are the small niche brands that maybe are only available in New York and San Francisco, but are exponentially growing and are likely to go cross country. So there's actually a lot of similarities between the way investors look at data and the way operators at these consumer packaged goods companies look at data. I think the key difference is the operator can do something about the data and then wants to measure the outcome of their action, whereas the hedge fund analyst takes no action. They just observe the world as it is and make bets based on that.
Despite everything we've been talking about, I often hear podcasts talk about this so-called commodification of credit card data. What do you say to people who claim that there's no alpha left in this kind of information?
Well, my tongue-in-cheek answer is that, Renaissance has been using accounting data and price market data for 30 years, and they seem to do a whole lot better than other hedge funds, despite it being a commodity. So, and I mean that quite seriously, right? There's a lot of commodity data sets like Capital IQ or CompuStats that everybody has access to, and yet everybody keeps buying and using, and some hedge funds do really well with it, and some hedge funds do poorly. So there's clearly alpha in it if used the right way. And I think the same is true of credit card data. I think when the alternative data industry in hedge funds got started, and call it 2013, 14, 15, I think there was just this like brief moment where not everybody was doing it, some people were doing it, and so just doing anything was alpha generating because most people were doing nothing. And you might see the same effect with AI. The first people to operationalize LLMs in trading might realize relatively easy profits, but that will become competed away. And so then the question becomes, okay, if everybody's access to the same data and market participants are equally informed, which will happen, then you have to compete on the quality of your analysis as opposed to on just access to the data. And frankly, that's a good thing. That's how efficient markets should work.
Yeah, I think your comparison to Renaissance Technologies is a really apt one, because the difference that might make the difference is talent. And on that note, I know you've written a lot about the qualities that separate successful alternative data scientists from those that work with more conventional data. Can you share a bit about that?
Yeah, so, and again, I'm not sure if this is specific to hedge funds or alternative data scientists, but I think it manifests itself well in this context. I think in general, there is a lack of data scientists who have commercial or business acumen, right? And this is fine in a typical data science team focused on internal data that are optimizing something. So, you know, the way I would describe it to people is like, you're a data scientist at, you know, some company, and you're trying to optimize the click-through rate of ads. And so you might be running A/B tests on those ads. And really, you don't need to know anything about what the company does. Like, you're mostly performing a statistical support function for telling the marketer which ad performed the best. And, you know, this is true of quantitative hedge funds as well. If you're a quant at Renaissance Technologies, you don't really need to know what Chipotle does or how they operate, or that Chipotle owns all of their own stores and McDonald's is a franchise business. That stuff doesn't really matter. You're solving a signal processing prediction problem that effectively, you know, boils down to forecasting a stochastic process. In market research, and market research at hedge funds has become known, as I mentioned, as alternative data, that's not enough. You need to actually understand what these businesses do to understand the right data set to apply to them. It's not obvious. And so figuring out which data set to apply and why analysis might not be predictive is most of the battle. The statistical methodology can be relatively commoditized, right? And so, you know, just basic examples include, if you take a bunch of credit card data and you model this revenue of Chipotle and McDonald's, you'll probably get an accurate answer for Chipotle, but not for McDonald's, because McDonald's is a franchise business, and so they make most of their money on licensing fees. So you might be measuring their gross systems profit or gross systems revenue, but you're not measuring their actual revenue. And so, like, these basic distinctions are really obvious. Like, they are painfully obvious to a hedge fund analyst or to, like, any kind of investment analyst. But they're not obvious to somebody who's, you know, has a master's in statistics. It just has nothing to do with learning statistics. And there's just a lack of people that have kind of both skill sets in one mind. So I think that's one big difference. I think a second thing I've noticed is, for better or for worse, there seem to be some problems in statistics that being a really good mathematician or a really good statistician is really helpful. So I would imagine developing the next generation of transformers is one of those problems, right? There also seems to be a category of problems in statistics in which that is not as helpful as being clever in just deciding which question to answer and what inputs to put into the model. And alternative data seems to be this latter case, where most of the relationships that you deal with in alternative data are linear. And if they're anything but linear, it sort of doesn't make sense, right? Why would spending at Chipotle be non-linearly correlated with revenue at Chipotle, right? It doesn't quite make sense. And so the models are trivial, but how you apply them requires some degree of taste. And this is interesting because, you know, I have listened to everything that Jim Simons at Renaissance Technologies put out there. And he mentions that one quality of a good researcher, beyond being good at math, is taste in what problems to pursue. Now, I would surmise to guess his definition of taste is very different from my definition of taste. But it's the same concept. It's knowing when to push further and when the problem is not worth it and you should reframe the question. And I can't quite describe how to teach that. There's just some people who have it and some people who don't. And I imagine the taste necessary to build the next transformer model is very different from the taste necessary to fix the credit card data to be more accurate.
I think it's such an interesting distinction. I heard an interview with Jim Simon's former colleague, Nick Patterson, and he mentioned that at Renaissance Technologies, they have, you know, this army of employees that are rocket scientists with two PhDs each, but a kind of open secret about the business is that they mostly perform linear regression with one independent variable and one target variable. The secret is that they can't tell you which variable to regress against, and they can't tell you which transformation to apply against your data first. That has to come from you.
Well, so actually you're touching on another question. Which is, are large language models and AI, are they useful in forecasting complex chaotic systems? And I think a lot of people's gut reaction is yes, but there's actually been no evidence of that at all. So if you think about most of the problems transformer models have done exceptionally well at. It's things like image recognition, video and image generation, text extraction, text summarization, classification. These are all things humans can do really well, but are limited by computation, attention, like information retrieval, and so on and so forth. To my knowledge, there's been no evidence that these transformer-based models have done well in places like weather prediction, geopolitical forecasting, stock market forecasting. So these chaotic systems that humans are bad at forecasting, there's no evidence really that neural networks have been the same order of magnitude better as they are at some of these high signal tasks, right? And so it's something I've been thinking about and about to write about is, you know, there's a few possibilities. The first possibility is that transformers, given enough computational power, will eventually become really great at these. So by the time we get to GPT-8, right, ChatGPT will predict the weather because it will just have enough information, and whatever function it is, it'll model that function and have the numeracy to do so. That's one possible outcome. A second possible outcome is that they will never, because some of these chaotic systems, are in many cases reflexive. So if you predict the stock market, the stock market participants act differently, and so now your model is no longer valid. And in some cases, because we don't have enough data, so think about weather, right? Weather and climate is very complex, and regimes in weather take decades to play out, just like regimes in the financial markets take decades to play out. And so, we actually haven't gone through enough regimes to build a generalizable model, right? Let's say you want to train a machine learning model to predict housing market crashes. Well, how many housing market crashes have happened in the last 30 years? Like what, basically, right? So it's kind of funny. It's like we actually don't have enough data despite having petabytes of it in some of these chaotic systems. If you want to predict things in astronomy, like how many times have we observed a cosmic event? Probably a handful of times in the last 300 years. So this is a big problem. And so you could take the pessimistic view and say these regime changes prevent us from having enough training data. That's another outcome. And then a third outcome that was pitched to me by a colleague that was very intriguing was these transformer models will never, they will never build the mathematical neural network to predict cosmic events or the financial stock market. But because they have access to every statistical tool and all the statistical knowledge humans have, they will simply learn to use linear regression or other statistical tools to solve the problem in kind of an agent-based fashion. So even though, a lot of these kind of quantitative hedge funds are using linear regression, these LLMs will beat them not by using nonlinear models, but by learning to use linear regression themselves in the right moments with the right inputs. So I thought that was fascinating. And that would be, the answer to that question will be very interesting.
I agree. And I mean, your point on chaotic systems and complexity is very well taken. And yet, even in very simple time series data examples, we find that these complex models don't outperform the very basic econometric models that we all learn in Econ 101. So
yeah, it's actually you're not exaggerating. There's so Amazon just released a foundational model called Kronos, and I think Salesforce released a time series based foundational model as well. So they're both transformer based foundational models for time series, and this startup called Nixtla basically compared the performance of those models to ensemble of econometric models like AutoArima and a collection of models, and the foundational models are slower and underperform the classic statistical literature, which just goes to show you could waste a lot of GPU power reinventing ArimA.
And so as a former quant, what do you think it is about the underlying structure of these very simple time series data models or data sets, excuse me, that make them impervious to machine intelligence?
So I think, first of all, the first statistical property they have is the signal is super weak, right? So if you think of it, like, let's take image recognition as an example. Like, is there a cat in this photo? Like, the answer is yes or no. And, you know, a human can do it perfectly. And there's enough information in that photo for sure, right? It's not, it's pretty deterministic. Whereas, is the stock market going to go up a penny or down a penny in the next second? I think is inherently much more random. Like, the best possible model for that process is probably only correct a small amount of time. There actually is a lot of noise. There's a lot of randomness. There is not a lot of randomness in the existence of a cat in the photo. So, like, in quant finance, like, people get excited over R squareds of like 0.05. And I just think that, like, when you compare R squareds of 0.05 to the, like, measure of fit you would accept for, say, an AUC curve for recognizing a cat in a photo, it's just not comparable. So my first hypothesis is it might be something to do with the fact that most of these models are operating in high signal environments, whereas some of these chaotic complex systems actually have something approximating true randomness in them. Not quantum randomness, but something approximating true randomness in a level that some of these other tasks don't have. So I think that's one issue. I think a second issue is what I mentioned before. I think a lot of these processes are regime driven, and we don't actually have enough observations of all the regimes to train a good enough model. Like, we just haven't seen enough recessions. There's only been a handful of recessions since the 1950s, right? We haven't seen enough climate change. We haven't seen enough cosmic events. We haven't seen enough hurricanes. Like, I think that's another big part of it. And then I think maybe the third category, so like signal to noise, number of observations, and then, you know, it's, well, I think those are probably the main differentiators. I can't think of a third.
One final question along this awesome tangent. Yuta Pearl, the computer scientist, believes that one fundamental misunderstanding we have in this current AI regime is that our minds aren't statistical machines, they're causal machines. Is there a missing area of research in the modern data science environment related to causality?
Maybe, but again, it goes back to my hypothesis around, so a famous statistician, Leo Breman, wrote a paper in 2001 called Two Cultures. And he talked about the causal statistical modeling, which was basically the dominant academic form of statistical modeling forever. And then, you know, black box statistical modeling, statistical learning, machine learning, what we call AI today. And, you know, obviously, culture two, the black box learning, has become in vogue and has led to huge advances, and computer science departments started competing with statistics departments and universities at prediction. And, you know, lo and behold, the neural networks, the computer scientists who had these wonky methods no statisticians took seriously, they've won. But, you know, the other question is, yeah, what about the causal models? What about culture one? Has that fallen behind? And again, maybe the answer is we need more people to think about causal modeling or Bayesian modeling or something like that. Or maybe these black boxes will do that for us, right? So this goes back to, what if the answer to predicting chaotic systems is not that the neural network learns the chaotic time series, but the neural network learns to apply all the statistical methods, causal methods that have been published, and apply them at the right moments in time, right? And so it could be true that we should actually just keep working on the black boxes, and the black boxes will figure out the causality models. That's possible too.
Okay, stepping back into the business of CyberSyn. In one of your previous talks, you said that there are three major challenges to the broader adoption of external data in major organizations: discoverability, which we've talked about, compliance, which we might get to, And lastly, fair pricing. And I think that last one is especially interesting because, in essence, CyberSyn's potential customers face the same challenge you did when previously working at a hedge fund, in that deciding what data set to buy is directly a function of the return you believe that data set can generate, which can be really hard to estimate. So on one hand, you have to guess at sort of the inherent value of the information. And on the other, you have to make a really subjective assessment of the value of that data in the hands of your team specifically. And that sounds like a lot to ask of data science teams who may be new to external data, especially because even when offering free trial periods, the payoff of that data might be, you know, at a very, very long time horizon. So how does CyberSyn help support that process?
Yeah, so you know, my point there, like the original point was that I think discriminatory pricing behavior in data sales is very annoying. So when I was at Coatue, we would have vendors, you know, say, okay, this data set's $1 million. And then they would go to the hedge fund that across the street that had a smaller data science team. And they would say, this data set's $500,000. And that felt fundamentally unfair. And what we're hoping to avoid with CyberSyn. The part you're talking about is the ROI calculation. And I disagree that this is like subjective, right? It's just because something is uncertain doesn't make it subjective. And so I think that there are, and we were certainly doing this at Coatue, and I think people can do it with backtesting at all types of firms. People can estimate what the ROI could be, and then they should expect to pay, you know, a percentage of that ROI, so some expected value, if you will, and take a bet. So, you know, if I sell somebody a data set, and there is, you know, some probability, let's say there's a probability they will save their firm $100 million. And then, you know, let's say that probability is 50%. And there's some probability that they will save the firm no money. So let's say that probability is 50%. Then, you know, their expected value is 50 million. And so if they buy that data set for $100,000, you know, but paying $100,000 for a 50 million EV bet, that's a pretty good deal. And yeah, it's possible it might not work out, but you know, that's life. When you hire people, they also might not work out. You still have to pay them their salaries. So I don't lose any sleep over the fact that different firms will have different levels of success in realizing the ROI. But I do think pricing needs to be consistent across use cases, right? So, hey, if you want to use my data for internal purposes, the price is X. If you want to use my data for external purposes or redistribution, the price is Y. And then you make the ROI calculation based on your use case on whether X is a fair price. I think that's kind of like the right model. The other, you know, the other method that's related to this pricing conversation is consumption-based pricing. So today, almost everybody pays subscriptions for data. And I think that makes sense. But there is something to be said that if you ask more questions of a data set more often, you know, in that case, the firm that's doing that, it might be fair for them to pay more than a firm that uses a data set once a year. Like, that seems fair. And so Snowflake supports usage-based pricing for data sets. And I think this has a ton of promise. That said, it's not common. So I would say customers are not used to usage-based pricing. You know, to be fair, usage-based pricing for enterprise software or cloud computing wasn't common until AWS and Snowflake made it so. And so I think it's possible that we move to a usage or consumption-based pricing model for data. And that feels fair.
Great answer. Continuing down that same path, there's one final objection I'd love to hear you react against, as it pertains to the adoption of external data outside of finance and within other businesses. And it's that these other businesses don't benefit from the same compounding returns that investors do. So in practice, if I'm an investor and I can go from being right 52% of the time to being right 54% of the time, that's a huge boost to my return profile over a long enough time horizon. But it's not clear if that asymmetric payoff exists in other industries. What do you say to that?
Oh, I think it really does. You know, so if you think about, let's say you're a large CPG firm and you're spending, you know, the largest CPG spends are spending tens of billions on advertising, right? So the impact on revenue or OpEx margin by making a better decision is exponential, right? So yeah, I hear you, right? Like if you're a hedge fund and you make $1 billion bet and you spent 100K on a data set and your $1 billion bet returns 20%, like you've made $200 million and you get 20% of that carry, so you've just made $40 million. Yeah, that's exponential. But if you're a large CPG firm and you spend $30 billion a year on advertising and you know you use some marketing attribution data set to reduce that advertising to 25 million or to reduce that advertising to 27 million, 10% reduction, right? That's $3 billion to the bottom line that you've basically returned, right? Like that's very significant. And you know, beyond reducing costs, you can also generate sales, you can generate top line. So I do think that data absolutely has the potential for operating companies to get these kind of exponential payoffs. I mean, you know, it goes back to the fact that a lot of these firms are capital allocators themselves. It's just they're not allocating capital to equities, they're allocating capital to marketing campaigns, or they're allocating capital to acquiring companies.
Okay, shifting gears. Beyond helping investors and businesses, the data you offer is potentially extremely valuable to governments as well.
Yeah.
You wrote an essay called "The Government Needs Fast Data," and in it you make a case for a sort of Manhattan Project for economic data. What are some of the current limitations and shortcomings with the status quo, and how can government institutions improve their estimates using data like the kind you offer?
So I think that, you know, there's very specific shortcomings around individual types of data sets, right? So, you know, just to give an example, it's well known, inflation uses rent equivalency to estimate cost of living. That's not a great estimate because not everybody's renting and the cost of ownership can be very different. Another example of a shortcoming Larry Summers pointed out is the cost of borrowing is not included in inflation metrics. And so even though, you know, we have a roaring economy and low inflation, consumers might be worse off. And that's why consumer sentiment is down because actually everybody's cost to borrow goes up. So I can pick at individual government metrics and say, here's the problem with that metric or here's the problem with that metric. But the systemic problem, in my opinion, is that, you know, we should be receiving more timely information and being able to query that information at a more granular level faster. So the most important decision that, in my opinion, the government makes, short of decisions of national security, most important decision is the federal funds rate. It determines who can get a mortgage, who can afford their mortgage, who gets a car loan, business loans. It drives our economy, right? And, you know, there seems to be something wrong if we're relying on, you know, 2 or 3 week delayed data that came from surveys. When all of that data is available digitally on kind of like an hourly basis in commercial databases. And so it seems like if we had faster data, we could probably react to things faster. And then beyond just being faster, because like, okay, once you get the data to be like daily, you probably don't need to go faster than that. You can make interest rate decisions very quickly. The kind of the second piece of this is you can start asking detailed questions. So, you know, like one great example would be the stimulus, the COVID stimulus and the multiple rounds of stimulus. I mean, it would have been very valuable if the government, if policymakers had access to detailed information about, for instance, what people on an aggregate basis did with the stimulus checks. And were those stimulus checks spent? Like, was there a Keynesian multiplier? Or were they saved? Were they invested in GameStop? I don't know. But being able to ask these kinds of granular questions to determine, do we need another stimulus check? Or if we grant a new stimulus check, is there a sub-demographic we could target, right? Is what is the right income level? Who needs this help the most? That to me sounds obviously better than relying on kind of quarterly or monthly aggregate metrics that then you can't interrogate further.
In preparation for our discussion today, I listened to a bunch of your previous interviews. I know you have a fascination with the book and the movie Moneyball.
Yeah.
And I think I've uncovered this sort of pattern in your thinking that I'd like to explore with you. When you were asked which university you wanted to attend, you said that you made this sort of analysis in your mind that if you got into a leading American school, it might be worth the investment, but if not, you'd stay in Canada. And when you were asked what you wanted to study, you said that you might not be the best computer scientist or the best business person, but you would be the best business person with computer science skills. And lastly, when deciding where to go work, you thought that going to a place like AQR might make you one quant among many, but going to Coatue, you'd be the quant leading this new part of the business. And it's almost like you've trained your mind to think in terms of edges. So I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, what's Cyberman's edge as you seek to grow a big business?
I think that people under... Sometimes it helps to zig when everybody else zags. And I think that people maybe undervalue the relative importance of time series data. Like, it's not the hot, sexy space. But market research, I think, actually is incredibly, incredibly important. And so in some ways, it's a continuation of the Coatue decision, which is, you know, lean into good business decision making and good investment skills while also doing something very technical. So I think in some cases, in one case, it's that. But I think it helps to think from things that first principles and say, like, what's different here? So I think Snowflake is a huge difference maker, right? The distribution and funding they were able to give us is tremendously helpful. And I think one thing people don't realize about data as a service companies is the CapEx required to get started is huge. And so I needed somebody to fund it that had a strategic reason to back us and had the pockets to actually support the effort while letting us still be a startup and do things in kind of a experimental, free-form, efficient, nimble way that you probably couldn't do at a large company. So I think I don't have the obvious cross-disciplinary analogy other than that. Then, you know, when I make decisions, I really think from first principles of like, where can I uniquely add value? And I think data as a service is maybe not in the limelight the way AI is, but I think it's so critically important that it seemed like too good of an opportunity to pass up.
Okay, this brings me to my final question. As we mentioned, you started your career at Coatue, and this is a firm that has a great reputation, but an especially good reputation when it comes to young people beginning their careers there. As you now seek to build a business of your own, how do you plan to bring that legacy forward and create a similar environment for Cybersyn?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, look, I'm super grateful to the folks at Coatue, you know, Philippe, Thomas, and Daniel for, you know, everything they did in terms of mentoring me and sort of helping me build the effort there and ultimately investing in Cybersyn as well. So I hope if I could just, you know, replicate a fraction of the excellence they've managed to create in that firm, I think that would be, you know, a lot to ask for. I think there's a few things that, you know, seem obviously translatable. I think the first thing is, you know, you have to give people some autonomy and, you know, allow them to take some risk, but then you have to hold them accountable. At the same time, it can't be, you know, one way or the other. And I think in some ways, Silicon Valley may have gone off the deep end in terms of not holding companies or individuals to account. And so this is where you got overhiring, overspending, and so on. So I think some, you know, autonomy and leverage, but with oversight, I think is pretty important. I think another, you know, thing that we probably did pretty well at Coatue, we called it sort of dreaming the dream, which is to say, you have to free your mind to think about if everything goes right, how could the world change? And so you have to open yourself to like the possibility of these kind of like tail events. You know, the example I like to give is a lot of people build risk models based on the worst event that has happened, right? So, you know, you're in the housing space, you want to build an event, you want to build a housing price model So you use the great financial crisis as kind of the worst case scenario and test yourself how you would have done in the worst case scenario. The problem is, you know, the moment before the great financial crisis, right, the worst case scenario hadn't happened, right? And so, and similarly, when people think about companies, you know, you could say, well, you know, the largest, like the total addressable market for XYZ is X. And then, you know, what you might discover is that the total addressable market for X is actually way bigger, right? And so that's why it's like not so helpful to say, well, the largest data as a service companies, S&P or Bloomberg, and those are $100 billion companies. It's like, well, guess what? The largest data as a service company might be a $1 trillion company. We just haven't seen it yet. So I think just being very aware of, you know, the opportunity and the exponentials and kind of dreaming the dream that way is like a little bit of inspiration that I maybe like indirectly picked up. But yeah, look, there's countless lessons from Coatue that I couldn't have. I couldn't possibly hope to recount all of them here.
Great answer. Well, Alex, thank you so much for the time you've given me today. Thank you for fighting the good fight, and thank you for having been a guest on the Splinter Podcast.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.